Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quinsey connecting the light. My guest today is Mel Duane. She is a certified life and recovery coach and author of a book which we will discuss called Alpha Chick, 5 Steps for Moving from Pain to Power. Welcome to the program, Mel.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's an honor to be with you today.
I'm pleased to hear that. I guess the title of your book, at least, Alpha Chick, does beg the question, since I've never heard of an Alpha Chick, what is it?
I knew you were going to ask that. An Alpha Chick, Michael, is an awakened woman. It's a woman that's working with a higher level of consciousness so that she becomes the deliberate creator of her life.
Right. So that's a name you penned yourself. It's an original one, evidently.
Yes.
Quite a clever idea, I think. Unforgettable, as you might say. Now, I do know that in your life experience, and you had one which possibly changed the course of your life, you recovered from a decades-long struggle with alcoholism. And you obviously don't mind people knowing that because you succeeded in overcoming it. But what bearing did that have on your life from that point onwards?
Well, I started using alcohol at a very young age, in my teens, to make myself feel better about myself because I had no self-esteem. And unfortunately, it really got its hooks into me. And that addiction, that dependency, lasted for 25 years. And alcohol worked for a while, but I'd say after about 10, 12 years, I didn't feel good anymore. And in fact, the opposite would happen. I would start to feel depressed, unhappy. And it finally, I got to a point on my journey where I just didn't want to go on the way I was going. And I was in a very dark place thinking that there were no options available to me and that maybe my only choice, in fact, might be death. That's how bleak I became. And at that moment, that lowest point, is when I had an epiphany, a spiritual awakening.
Right. Are you going to tell us about that one?
Yes, I am. I heard a voice that I never heard before telling me that I would survive. I would be fine. And in fact, I would have a very good life ahead of me. But I had lessons I needed to learn. And then once I learned those lessons, really mastered them, I would need to go and teach others and share that information. And that was the beginning of my own personal transformation. It didn't happen, you know, overnight. It has been a journey. But I did learn my lessons, and I'm now at that stage, and I have been for the past 10 years, where I want to give that information away that I've learned, that transformational process, which I've used, which is very simple but very powerful.
Was that the only occasion in your life that you heard that type of advice through the voice?
No, it's been ongoing. And in fact, what happened is I've really started a daily spiritual practice in my life. And when I'm meditating or praying or even journaling sometimes, writing things down, that voice will come to me. And I've gotten many, many, many messages, which I've written down over the years. And I have notebooks of them. And I've been actually, this year, I started posting them to my website as soul notes because I was told to share them with other people, that they would bring comfort to other people. So I've been putting them up on my blog.
Oh, that's wonderful. But would it be true to say that in the circumstances they have been of a personal nature, yet at the same time they are evidently applicable to anybody else with problems?
Yes, they're like lessons in life about dealing with fear, dealing with anger, resentment. They're wonderful. They are so comforting. And most people can read them and get something out of them. Now, some days they might apply to exactly what I was feeling that day, but the message itself could be appreciated by anybody that might be having a fear about not having enough money to pay a bill a certain day or something like that.
Right. So the messages are of a general nature, and it enables you, presumably, to cope with any type of problem. You're not sort of specialising beyond the fact that you're helping people to recover from their struggles like you did.
Yes.
What was the greatest help that you personally had in overcoming your problems?
I think the greatest help that I've had is using this process that, again, came to me through my meditation. I'm going to use the word channeled for lack of a better description.
Right.
And I've used this process over and over again, and I've now used it with women over the past 10 years, other women that I've worked with. And I think that this has really kept me on a very clear path of personal transformation and empowerment. And every time something flares up in my life, because we know life is not perfect, and we're always going to have challenges and disappointments and painful things, that when something comes up that I find extremely difficult, I immediately go into this process, these five steps, and utilize them to work my way through the situation.
Yes, I thought that was, again, rather clever to have your five steps making up the word faith, because that's the sixth step, isn't it, really?
Well, the steps do spell faith, and I was that was channeled to me, and I originally thought I had seven steps, and then during a meditation, I was told, "Oh no, dear child, there are five steps, and they spell faith." And I was like, oh my, oh, okay. And the faith to me, my definition now of faith is it's a process as well as the desired outcome. And it's the root for personal transformation. When I speak of faith, I'm not speaking of it in a religious sense as far as any specific religion. I am talking about a belief and a knowing within yourself.
Yes. But I would guess it also means having the faith in your own belief that you have the power to overcome.
Yes. Exactly, Michael.
Well, that's the end of the interview then, I think. Yes, we've got to the end already. Now, all joking apart, I think you would describe your life experience as having been to hell and back.
Yeah.
But now you've overcome that, and I'm guessing you've got a sort of totally different personality now. Can you look back and see the lessons that taught you?
Yes. Well, first of all, most of the things I've experienced are very common with women. A dependency. failed relationships, a failed marriage, the loss of, you know, the death of a loved one. These are things that women experience. And so what's happened to me has happened to many, many women. And this is part of life, unfortunately. And so by working this process and, you know, tapping into the faith, I was able to work through these. Now, my personality, per se, hasn't changed much, except that today I live with complete gratitude and appreciation. My personality is pretty similar. I've always had a good sense of humor, and but now I have a different belief system and a definite, you know, much different life, and a life full of just joy and personal power that I didn't have before. So the quality of my life has changed. I don't know if my personality has changed that much, but definitely the quality of my life. It's very different.
Hmm. Would you say that some addictions, now I'm not necessarily thinking of alcohol, but maybe that is at the top of the list along with smoking, would you say some of them are the result of weaknesses, if you like, that are caused by genetic inheritance? For example, you find in some families that there are succession of people in the family or earlier generations that seem to have the same illnesses. So do you think there is a weakness that has a genetic source?
Well, I'm not a medical doctor, so I don't want to speak on medical terms, but I saw it in my own family that there was a very strong threat of alcoholism. And I had cousins that experienced the same problem that I had. Mm. So, and I've read that there is a genetic, you know, thread to alcoholism, that it can be passed. So, you know, I think my own personal case, it was a little bit of both. I think it was a little bit of genetic, and also the fact that I had no self-esteem. And when I've worked with and talked to so many women that are addicted to alcohol or food or sex or shopping or gambling or whatever it is, the root of the problem is usually because they don't feel good about themselves. It's interesting. Most women use a substance or a behavior because they don't feel good about themselves.
Right. Well, the reason I raised that question is I have to feel that if you start out life with, say, genetic, I'll call it a weakness, when you fall into that, shall we call it, trap, I suspect it's going to be much harder to get out of it, say, than someone else who dabbles in these things and can either have it or leave it without any problem at all.
Well, in my family, there were three children, but I'm the only one that seemed to really pick up and grab on to using alcohol as a form of comfort. So why didn't the other two do it? You know, who knows? I don't think it made my recovery any more difficult. I did what I had to do, and I was blessed because I saw the light right away. That voice came to me immediately and said, "You're going to do this. You're going to be okay." I never was hospitalized. I never did a detox or any of that. I did go, you know, right to AA meetings and did all of that faithfully, and it really worked for me. But on top of that, I discovered a spiritual practice. Maybe AA triggered that in me a little bit, the spirituality. But then I really went down a path of a daily regimen and very disciplined in what I was reading and, you know, things that I would get involved in. So, you know, I might have supplemented my recovery, I would say, through my own efforts along with you know, being part of the AA program.
Right. Do you think that some people prevent their recovery by carrying a guilt complex along with it?
Oh, guilt is such a nasty word. And yes, I think that people carry huge guilt when they have an addiction. And I think it makes it very hard because inevitably we've hurt other people by the fact that we have an addiction.
Right.
And if it's not saying something or doing something, it's lying to somebody, we hurt other people. And that's the guilt. I mean, it's really an awful thing. But to move forward in recovering, I think you have to make amends with people, and any program that you're involved in will advise you to try to make things right with people if possible. In some situations, you can't. You can't go back. It might cause more pain than it would helping the situation. But guilt is a tough one. It's definitely, you know, a part of recovery that's a big challenge.
Do you think people find it hard to forgive themselves in that situation? Because you often find in spiritual teachings that they talk about you loving yourself first before you can love other people.
Yes. Well, it's in my five steps, I talk about acceptance. And I think this is very important for somebody in recovery. It was the second step of the five steps. And forgiveness and acceptance, they're very similar, but why acceptance works so well for somebody that's maybe in recovery is that once I was able to look at all the things that I did that I didn't think were right and accept them, that I had done them, okay, I accept these things, not that I'm making them right or making them wrong, but I accept that they happened, and they're not who I am. They don't define my character. They don't define me as a woman. It's not who I am today. I was able to release them. That self-bondage to that stuff went away. I was free of it. And it was a huge part of moving forward, because once I accepted those things and the strength and the hold that they had on me dissipated, my attitude about all of this changed dramatically, and my attitude about myself. And I think when that attitude changes, that's part of that forgiveness that you're talking about.
Right. Now, I know that you talk of the divine power within.
Yes.
That sounds very much a spiritual interpretation. What did you mean by that?
To me, it was this level of consciousness that I was tapping into, a form of guidance that was coming from within me, that was entirely different than anything I had listened to before. And it was a different vibration, a different energy. I don't want to use the word Christ consciousness because not everybody's a believer of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a higher, universal, energetic form of communication that we all have. We're all born with it. It's within us. We just have to quiet our minds down to find it and to listen to it. It's really our authentic voice that's coming through.
Yes, I think some people, including myself, might well describe that as our higher self.
Yes. Yes. Higher self, higher power, higher consciousness. Yes.
It's that little voice. I was going to say it's that little voice sometimes that steps in to give us very sensible advice when we're in danger of doing something silly, I think.
Absolutely.
Right. I think it's nice to refer to it as Christ consciousness because that probably conveys a very high level of consciousness, mm-hmm. but I mm-hmm. accept your point. You've maybe got to find a description that can suit everybody without putting them off.
Mm-hmm. Not everybody's, you know, embraces, and I think this is the problem that people have with AA when they're mm-hmm. trying to recover, or if they're in another program that is, you know, a branch of AA, if it's, you know, overeaters or whatever. There's a lot of language about God, and a lot of people, or when they talk about a higher power, that it's more of a reference of God, a lot of people can't embrace that. But they can embrace the fact that there is a higher level of consciousness that created the universe, puts the stars in the sky, puts the leaves on the trees, and that same consciousness, that same energy is within all of us. And that's the authentic voice. That's that higher knowledge.
Yes, I certainly agree with you on that. I wonder, though, if people recognize what it is in the sense that it is something they should listen to, because I guess there is a battle between the little voice that talk sense on your mm-hmm. ego that sometimes doesn't want to listen.
It's funny. I call my ego voice, that nasty screeching little voice that can go off in my head, Louise. And I know the difference right away because mm. Louise has a real edge. She knows it all. You can't tell her anything. And when Louise is talking a mile a minute about how I'm not going to do something right and, you know, I'll make a mess of it and they're not going to want to talk to you anyways, I can identify that that is that ego voice, that miserable little ego that is screaming, that's trying to hold us back, to keep us locked into fear, to keep us from moving forward and touching and getting communicating and getting connected to really that higher voice. Our ego does not want us to do that. They are arch enemies. So for me, I made an identification to that awful egoic voice, and it really has helped me tremendously, because then I know who I'm listening to.
Yes. Right, now, you talk in your book about controlling our choices, how to create new patterns of thinking to help us awaken our ability to choose in life. So what problems do you think our thinking can cause if we are not trying to create new patterns? I mean, do you find a particular problem with the way people think when they have some addiction or any other serious problem?
Our thoughts, there's been a lot written about the power of positive thinking. And our thoughts really control what we're going to bring into our existence. You know, it's the law of attraction. It's the law of reciprocity. You throw positive thoughts out there, you get a positive response. You throw negative energy, negative thoughts out there, you're going to get a negative response. And I think when you're in recovery, one of the things that you really have to do is be very, very aware of what you're thinking. Because where we are in recovery, and we're all already working with the guilt, and we're already, you know, trying to work around forgiveness and acceptance, To be conscious of that thought that's in your head, you can only hold one thought at a time. So why not make it a good one? one that's going to make you feel good, one that's going to elevate the energy in your body, one that's going to elevate the consciousness of your mind rather than negative thoughts. It takes practice. It doesn't come easily. It does take practice. It's something all of us can do.
Yeah.
That's the good news. We all can do it.
Right. Yeah, I totally believe that. And you mentioned the law of attraction, and I'm guessing here that it takes people some time to understand that what you focus on is what you get. So you really have to take your focus away from those things that you don't want.
Exactly. And unfortunately, as human beings, and I have to say, Michael, I think everybody's recovering from something. I really do. I have found that just in my own work with everybody I talk to. Everybody has something they're recovering from. It may be a lost job right now that's really hurt somebody emotionally and financially. Everybody's got something going on. And if you focus on the negativity of the situation, of what's upsetting you, then you're only creating more of that negative energy. If you can take this particular thing that has happened, that has caused you pain, suffering, discomfort, and fear, and reframe it and use it as a lesson, what can I take out of this that will teach me something? I use all my pain to teach myself how to transform my life. And that would be what I would advise anybody right now that feels that they're suffering, that there's something wrong in their life, your listeners, if somebody has a particular issue in their lives that they're having difficulty dealing with, is to look at that particular situation as a lesson. What can I learn from this? And start to write these things down. It's not so much what's positive, but what am I learning here? What can I learn from this? That maybe I don't want to do that again, or maybe I shouldn't say that, or maybe, but it get some lessons from it. Use it to empower yourself. Use it to establish and reframe eventually how you think about it, because you're going to get a lesson from it.
Yeah, I think at times life is pretty hard for nearly all of us. I mean, we have ups and downs, but what do you think the purpose of life is?
Ooh, powerful question.
Call to unawareness there.
That's a powerful question.
Indeed it is, yes.
I think we are all put on this earth. I think we are all created. First of all, not to suffer. We were not put here to suffer. We were created to live with joy and passion and purpose. And I think purpose is a very important word. Without purpose, you really don't have a path to walk along. You don't have a sense of direction. And many people will do things in life, in careers, and show up every day at the same job for 30 years, hate it, come home, drink, and wish they had done something else. And I think if you work from the heart, you have purpose. You know what you're doing. You're doing it because you love it. And to have purpose means you have a meaning. You're having a meaningful experience. And when you have purpose, you're also serving others. You're doing something for others with good intention. So I think purpose. We're put on this earth to discover how we will best serve others while we are here. That, to me, is what life is about.
Right. Do you think in the ultimate that we're here to discover unconditional love?
Yes, I think that's part of it. And I think that unconditional love is one of the components of our purpose. And I think that's a wonderful item to add to all of this that you've just brought up. Unconditional love is so important. You don't see it very often. You see it with animals all the time, but you rarely see it in humans, because we always have this judgment that we have to judge others, and that's the ego talking, and yes. To you know, we're always in judgment of others, or if they do this, then I will love them, and if they do that, then I won't. Unconditional love is such a magnificent state, and that's why I love animals so much, because they always unconditionally love us. Whether you feed them, you bathe them, you walk them, they're still at your side. So animals are great teachers.
Indeed, you're very correct about that, because wherever we are, we cannot help but hear or read about animal cruelty, and yet in spite of that, as you're indicating there, animals will come back to their masters or their owners.
Yes.
They don't come back and bite their legs off, they come back wagging their tail and wanting to sort of kiss them in a animal-type way.
Yes. So we could learn so much from animals about loving one another unconditionally.
That's a hard one, though, isn't it, really?
Yes.
Because there is so much friction and so much coarseness in the world, and a lot of it comes directly from individuals.
Yeah, I was talking to a woman today that was abused by her father.
Yes.
How do you keep unconditional love with somebody that violates you like that as a young child?
Yes.
It's a tough lesson.
It is, isn't it?
But it starts with accepting that it happened. And that doesn't make it right or wrong. It happened.
Yeah.
Part of your history, okay? It's history. It's not happening today. But that's one that I think of that, you know, creates really a very tough thing for women to be able to turn and continue to love that person.
Yes.
And it takes great strength and enormous, enormous faith in yourself as a human being to be able to turn and love that person. They're your father. They obviously had a very, very deep problem, an issue, you know, and to try to keep some type of love for that human being, that's probably the biggest challenge.
Yes. And I also think that in those type of cases, those particular people actually need our love, and if anything is going to change them, that is probably the energy that will have some effect.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right in saying that giving them or showing them some love or some type of compassion is probably the way to heal somebody that does that kind of thing.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Again, it's a hard one for the victim to be able to take that step.
Mm-hmm.
But it happens, though, doesn't it?
Pardon me?
It does happen.
You
come across people that can be totally forgiven and offer love instead.
Yes.
Right, now, we sort of started off by talking about addictions, but can you help anyone regardless of what their addiction is?
Well, I don't want to profess to be giving any type of medical treatment when it comes to addiction. So what I want to recommend first is that anybody, you know, any one of your listeners who feels they have an addiction, and the best way that I can describe that in kind of humorous way is if the tail is wagging the dog, it's time to get help. So if somebody feels that their life is becoming out of control, I think you need to deal with this issue medically first. It has to be dealt with the appropriate people that can help you physically.
Mm. Do you think people in most cases take up or get involved in addictions because they have emotional issues?
Yes. Yeah. Overall, I think it's usually emotionally based. From my experience with women, it's usually an emotional reaction that they're doing it because something is causing them pain.
Yes.
So you have to deal with it on a medical level first, and you've got to have, you know, treatment. You've got to deal with that. I think that the five steps of faith are a wonderful daily practice ritual that will strengthen anyone in their recovery. It will help them. It will give them a clarity about who they are, what they are, where they want to go, that maybe they did not have before. So that's what I love about the process. I think it shows us options that we never knew were available, that all along we did have choices, that we can leave this pain and suffering and past mistakes behind, and we can step into our power. And I think that's what this process does for us.
You talk about identifying negative behaviors and beliefs that hold us back in life.
Yes.
Have you got some general advice that would help people to deal with that?
Yes. The identifying your negative behaviors and setting new intentions is the second step of the process. And what I recommend is that, first of all, you look at what you're doing that's really self-sabotaging your efforts. And it's very easy, I think, for anyone, whether they're in recovery, not in recovery, and this process will work for anyone. You don't have to be in recovery to do this. But I think if you can look at the things that you know you are doing on a repetitive basis that are hindering you and holding you back and, you know, self-sabotaging your good efforts, it's time to identify those things and then say, okay, how do I replace this? What do I do instead of that? And that's where the intention comes in. And the reason why I use the word intention was because a goal is like a wish. You write it on a piece of paper. But an intention has soul behind it. And it's much more powerful. So if you set new intentions, when I come home every day from work, I'm eating a box of cookies. And I'm an overeater, and I don't want to continue eating because I've put on 50 pounds. So you've identified something that you're doing on a daily basis that no longer works for you, and it's hurting you, and it's negating everything else you're trying to do. So you set a new intention. When I come home from work every day, I'm going to cut an apple up and eat that scrumptious apple and still get the flavor of sweets, but put something into my body that's going to help me and set a new powerful intention. And that's how we can change our lives, is through intention.
Right.
By setting these new intentions.
Yes, it's sort of like making a New Year's resolution, isn't it, in a way?
Well, it's even stronger than resolutions, because resolutions don't have soul behind them. Resolutions are usually good ideas that never come about. But if you start setting an intention, it's much stronger. It's got a lot more energy behind it, and tension is coming out of the soul.
Right, so what do you want the reader to take away from your book? I mean, what is the most important message that you think is in it?
That every single person has the ability to transform their life. That there are options, that they have choices, and they have the power. They were born with the power. They're just not tapping into it. But it's there.
Yes, indeed. Now, your book is directed at women. I don't know whether men can gain some value from what you write about. I suspect they can. But just thinking of women in particular, are they at any great risk at any particular age, that is, of acquiring addictions?
It's kind of sad, actually. I'm seeing women that are younger and younger and younger starting to abuse pills and alcohol. I mean, high school age. It's scary. It was very unusual when I was in high school that I was drinking, and it was uncommon. So now it's prevalent. And I don't think these young women realize that this drinking or these pills are really going to get into them. It's going to put the hooks in that tender flesh. I don't think they understand that. So that's one area where I'm seeing something that's extremely alarming. And I think there has to be much more control and supervision over what young people are watching on television, because I think it's poison. But what I do see is women in their 30s start to realize that their life isn't what they had hoped, that their marriage isn't what they hoped it would be, that their relationship isn't what they hoped it would be, or that their career isn't. And so they start to step up a bit in their use of something to offset the emptiness and the disappointment that they're feeling. And then as you get into your 40s, that magnifies. I think it's hormonal, I think it's age, and it's like, oh my gosh, now I'm in my 40s, and, you know, what opportunity am I going to have now to change my life? Well, look at Betty White, who's 90, and look what she's done with her life in the last 10 years. She's reinvented herself as one of the biggest stars in movies and television. So I think she's just such a powerful example. So women who like to drink, I think they start to get into trouble more as they mature, because they start to see their lives as being incomplete. And if we can stop the teenagers now and start to educate them about the fact of how to deal with disappointment, how to deal with a failed relationship, how to build self-esteem, how to develop confidence and self-love at an early age, I think we can stop a lot of the early abuse that's starting to take place.
I can't help feeling that some of the problems young people feel very deeply is that the state of the world at the moment is causing so much concern that they can't really see much of a future for themselves. And I think that must be the reason why some turn to drugs and drink. It's almost to cut off your senses or your feelings to get away from it.
Michael, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think that the world is in a very difficult time. And I'll share with you a message that I received in a meditation about all of this. And I was deeply concerned about how difficult things had become financially. Not only for myself, my own business being real estate, which has declined dramatically, but just so many other people I know. And the message I got was that this was a teaching, a universal teaching, for people to start to learn to appreciate what's really important in life. That people had become consumed with greed and were living way beyond their means and had lost touch of true values in their lives. And that that what they felt was important was strictly monetary gains and acquiring more. And so what it was a slap on the hand for everybody worldwide, didn't matter where you lived, to show you and to bring you back. It was a correction about what really is important in life and how to learn to live without all these extra things that are meaningless. And I really feel that's what's happening. Greed. Greed became so crazy. People couldn't make money fast enough, spend it fast enough. Banks couldn't get it fast enough through bad loans to people and mortgages that never should have been written. I mean, it just goes on and on. These hedge funds and these stock brokerage companies, everybody trading, wheeling and dealing as fast as they could. People were making so much money on paper that it was insanity.
Yes.
Oh, and it all came to a screeching halt.
You're totally correct on that, I'm sure. We haven't by any means reached the end of the program at the moment, but I would like to give you the opportunity to talk about the Catherine Holly Riley School in Mali, West Africa, because I believe that is one of your achievements, and no doubt you're very modest about it, but tell us a little bit as to how that came about.
This is, so far in my life, to me, the best thing I've ever done. It's my best achievement to be able to build that school. And I built the school in memory of my niece who has passed away.
Right.
And she was a passionate young woman. She loved education. She loved children. She was in law school to become an advocate for children. And grief is a process. And when she first died, I was in uncontrollable sobbing and loss. And then I went through a phase of, I was angry. And now I've progressed to a stage where I want to honor her spirit. She taught me a powerful message about living life. And it was to live my life every day and do the very, very best I could do that day. And then start fresh tomorrow. And so the opportunity presented itself to build a school with this organization called We Are Family. And I thought about it, and I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to build this school. And I started to build the school in 2006 when the real estate market started to go right down the toilet. But I still built the school, and there's 100 children who are getting an education that never would have had that opportunity. And what really is wonderful, it is that it's boys and girls, and that's unheard of in that area of the world. It doesn't happen.
Well, I think that's a wonderful gesture, and you clearly came into life with this mission, I think, already written into your life plan, and in one way or another, I think you, if you lived your life again, you would still probably do the same things.
I probably would. I'm passionate about helping people. I'm passionate about helping women, and what I realized in writing the book was that I traveled that journey that was like a minefield for a reason. It all made sense. that I travel that path to take me to where I am today so that I can give women this knowledge. I can share this process with them. I can help them. It became very clear to me that I was destined to do that so that I could be where I'm at today.
Yes, I totally agree with that. Now, we are coming to the closing minutes. Would you like to tell our listeners if you wish to make your email address available and give them your website address?
Please,
tell
I would love
where
to.
Tell them where they can get your book from.
Yes. You go to alphachick.com, www.alphachick.com. And at the top of the page, there are two new buttons, one's for the TELUS Summit, which will be coming up on February 7th, 8th, and 9th. I have some leading famous luminaries that will be appearing with me on this TELUS Summit. Lisa Coffey, Joseph Rubino, Christine Clozier. These are people that are recognized for what they do in transformation and self-esteem and empowerment. Right. And that's all on the 7th, 8th, and 9th, and the TELUS Summit button will take them right to the sign-up. And then there's also a button for free gifts, and if the book is being launched on February 14th on Amazon.com. And I picked Valentine's Day specifically because I wanted women to give themselves a gift of self-love on that day.
What a lovely thought, yes.
And so if they purchase the book on February 14th, they are going to get all these wonderful free gifts that go with the book from leading authors and other people in the transformational field. It's so exciting. And then my personal email, it's right up on the website. You can email me at maldwayne@alphachick.com if you have a specific question. I will be happy to get back to you. I am in a little bit of a media tour right now, so I might need 48 hours to respond, just depending on what's happening in the course of a day. But I will get back to you.
Well, I think that's a very wonderful offer.
Oh, thank you. And I want women to, you know, read this material, whatever way they can get it, and use this to transform their lives. To lift that consciousness, to start to tap into their authentic voice. And you mentioned men, and I've been interviewed by several men.
Yes.
You can use this process. It works regardless. It's for men or women, but I wrote the book for women.
Right. I'm sure that's correct. I mean, we're all human beings, and
yes,
we tend to suffer from the same problems. But, Mal,
yes,
it's been very nice to have you on, and excellent to speak with you. You certainly know what you've come here to do, and I wish you every success with the book.
Thank you so much, Michael, and it's an honor to be here today with you and with your listeners. I truly appreciate this opportunity.
Well, we appreciate you. Thank you very much, Mal.
Thank
right,
you.
Right, friends, yet again, we have a very interesting guest. Next week, I have Randall C. Shelton, who's an author and speaker. And we're going to talk about his book, Life on Earth, The Game. And he believes we are in a cosmic game. So that certainly sounds very interesting. So thank you for being with me today, and I do hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.